You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an urban planning professor explains the state of Wisconsin's housing market. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about pushing the boundaries of coffee in Milwaukee.
The culture of coffee can be seen everywhere, from the aisles of your local grocery store to the wide variety of options on the menus at big box chains and small local shops. Wisconsinite Ryan Castellaz is on a quest to raise the bar even further for the drink he's so passionate about. He's the founder of Discourse Coffee in Milwaukee and the author of the new book, The New Art of Coffee, From Morning Cup to Caffeine Cocktail. He says it all started when he was studying abroad to become an opera singer.
And when I was in Italy training, I fell really, really in love with espresso culture, like this ritual of going to the bar every morning, putting my euro coin down on the bar, getting my shot of espresso, taking it down. It became something I fell deeply in love with. And when I moved back to the States, I needed to recreate that culture in my life.
His mom bought him a home espresso machine for his dorm room, and he fell in love with sharing his passion with others.
It wasn't until several years later that I kind of came to this confluence of the storytelling that I loved in music and the craft of making coffee and how those two things kind of came together.
That's when he opened the original Discourse Coffee in Sister Bay. He says that the economy of coffee is about volume and productivity, but he wanted to try something different, work on a smaller scale.
And so I think this smaller niche model that is less focused on the profitability and more focused on barista expression is something that is new and exciting, but something that's a little bit more foreign to the traditional model of running a coffee shop.
He describes the evolution of coffee culture as having three waves. First, Folgers and Maxwell House, convenience. The second is shops like Starbucks.
They kind of split the balance between convenience and quality. It's definitely a step up. You have these creative solutions, but it's still very much a productivity-driven model.
He says the third wave is about transparency, choosing the right bean, the right roast, and letting it shine on its own.
It involves the barista getting out of the way. It involves the barista diving in that coffee to perfection, but not to their own expression, to the expression of the farmer, to the expression of the roaster, to be an expert translator in the intention of the coffee.
Now, with his shop in Milwaukee and his new book, Castellaz wants to power a fourth wave.
With the fourth wave, we give the barista a voice. We say the point of this is barista expression. We've gotten really good at making good coffee. And so in the fourth wave, instead of making great transparent coffee the goal, great transparent coffee is the baseline. And if you think about this like a cocktail bar, right? Like a bartender, what they do, they take amazing spirits from all around the world and then they translate them into their own voice through their cocktails. And so what the fourth wave is it's saying, hey, baristas should have some of that fun too. It's bringing that mentality into the coffee space of saying, hey, we're going to take these amazing transparent coffees from around the world. We're going to serve them to you in a beautiful format, but we're also going to play with them and we're going to express ourselves through them. And that focus on novel engagements with the customer, with the guest, that is the fourth wave.
And in his book, he explores four different moods for coffee concoctions and cocktails.
The moods in the book that we've chosen are comforting, rejuvenating, adventurous, and celebratory.
He thinks we're all emotional drinkers, and he believes coffee has the flexibility to meet us where we're at.
And so in the book, we wanted to make it very, very easy for the reader to take a look at the book and say, hey, what do I feel like right now? Do I feel adventurous? Do I want something that's going to comfort me? And then immediately guide the viewer, the reader, right to that section. We wanted to make this as easy to use, actually use, as possible.
And now he wants to continue to evolve, to deepen the connections that are possible through coffee.
To have a longer format of time with people, to be able to do a tasting menu with somebody where we can really talk to them about all of the thought that goes into these drinks. That, I think, is the next step for us. It's being able to bring people even more deeply into the story of who we are and what we do.
For more on Ryan Castellaz, his coffee shop, and book, visit wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now, Wisconsin residents are paying record amounts for homes this year. According to last month's numbers from the Wisconsin Realtors Association, the state's median house price is nearly $295,000. At the same time, home sales are down by more than 20%. Interest rate hikes from the Federal Reserve are raising mortgage costs, and the construction sector nationally is lagging behind demand. I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you bought or sold a home lately or decided not to? Share your experience. How do you feel about the state of the housing market? Realtors, what are you seeing in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kurt Paulson is a professor of urban planning at UW-Madison's Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture. Kurt, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I talked to you just over a year ago. At that point, you described Wisconsin's housing affordability as a five-alarm fire. Are things looking any better or worse now compared to then?
Well, yeah, I remember that. And I'm wondering if we can coin a term, a seven or eight alarm fire. Because when I talked to you last year, mortgage interest rates were about 5.7%. Now they're up to 6.7%, right? And as you pointed out, house prices in Wisconsin have jumped $25,000 to $40,000 in some markets since last year. So in many ways, things have gotten worse. It is still a seller's market. We hear stories of all cash offers well above listing price. You know, the peak home buying months are April, May, and June. And as you pointed out, sales are way down and prices are way up. So for people looking to buy a home, it's tough out there.
What is driving the costs of the houses up right now?
So there's a couple of factors that all come together, right? So that we have seen that even though interest rates have gone up, there's still tremendous demand for housing, oftentimes by people who are older and have enough income to pay in cash. And so demand for housing has not really declined, even though interest rates have gone up. But one of the largest drivers is just a lack of inventory. So there's the short term and there's the long term. In the long term, we just have not built enough housing over the last 15 years to keep up with demand. And in the short run, in the last 2 years, the cost of construction has gone up about 35%. So when it costs a lot more money to build a new house, then the price of existing housing goes up. And I would say that the other challenge is that when interest rates were really low during the COVID pandemic, people like me refinanced our mortgages well below 3%. So many of us are stuck. There's no way that we could afford to move or sell and then have to take an interest rate closer to 7% when our current rate is below 3%. So it's really multiple factors that lead to just incredible demand, a lack of supply, and not a lot of movement in housing.
You mentioned those cash buyers. Often people established economically, they can come and buy a house, not worry about those mortgage interest rates. Now, does this end up hurting maybe that first-time home buyer who hasn't built up that equity in an older house or however they're paying for it and is at the mercy of our current mortgage rates? Are they the hardest hit here?
Absolutely. And so particularly anyone who's trying to use a like an FHA or a VA loan is going to lose out to an all-cash buyer. And all-cash buyers can afford to have no contingencies on financing, and they usually can pay over asking. So, yeah, we are seeing this particularly in Wisconsin and nationwide, that it's millennials who are competing against baby boomers for the same housing, and the baby boomers are winning. And that assumes that the millennials have been able to save enough for a down payment, which is oftentimes not the case. So it's really impacting first-time home buyers much harder than kind of move-up or second-time home buyers.
Let's talk about the construction side of things. I was looking at a longer-term chart of construction, new house construction. No surprise, after the Great Recession hit 2008, 2009, that plummeted. That went way down. Are we still feeling the gap left by that post-recession reluctance to build houses that weren't going to be worth as much as they had been 2 years before?
Absolutely. So, you know, before the Great Recession, we used to build about 35,000 housing units per year in the state of Wisconsin. But in the last 3 years, we've only built about 21,000 a year. So even on a per capita basis, we are way down in terms of what we have been able to produce over the last 15 years. In fact, last year, 2022, building permits in Wisconsin were down, even though our demand is up. That's largely driven by some of the difficulties for developers of ownership or rental housing to secure financing. So the other factor I think we should mention is that banks have significantly tightened lending to developers for building new housing, largely driven by some of the scares that we had a few months ago from the Silicon Valley Bank crisis.
Kurt Paulson is with us, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison's Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture, looking at the housing market in Wisconsin. With high prices, mortgage rates going up, low turnover, it's a perfect storm in all the bad ways. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you been looking to buy a home? Success? Or still looking? What are the obstacles you're facing? If so, have you sold a house lately, or have you looked around in the market and decided, hey, I guess I'm better off staying with this lower mortgage rate for a while now? Join in with your experiences or your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Kurt Paulson, urban planning professor at UW-Madison, looking at the state of Wisconsin's housing market. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do things look like in your neck of the woods? Whether you're looking or you know people who are, is it easy to find and buy a home? Difficult? How's rent looking if you're in the rental market? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Dave is with us in Chippewa Falls. Dave, hi.
Hi. Hi, thanks for having me on. So I'm a home inspector here in Chippewa Falls, and I'm seeing a lot of first-time home buyers that are making offers, and they're afraid to put a home inspection contingency because they're afraid they won't get the house. And yet the only thing that is in their price range are usually really old houses if they're small, especially. And we haven't built small houses for a really long time unless it's a condo. And condos are overpriced for a lot of these first-time home buyers. And so I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
Dave, thanks for the call. A lot of news from the field there, Kurt. What do you think?
Yeah, Dave is exactly right. As I talked about before, when you're facing an all-cash buyer and you're trying to compete for that more affordable housing product, it's usually an older housing unit. And if you put an inspection contingency on your offer, which, you know, I think anyone in the business would tell you, you should get a house inspected by someone like Dave, who can help you figure out if the furnace is going to go bad or if the roof is going to leak. And that's what we used to do all the time, is put an inspection contingency on a home purchase offer. But, you know, sellers are going to choose the offer that has no contingencies. And so, as Dave pointed out, people are buying older homes without an inspection, and then they're hit with all sorts of surprises and expensive repair bills. And there's really not a lot we can do about that right now until the housing market cools off again, right? We think that the balance between sellers and buyers is usually about equal when there's about 6 months of supply on the market, and right now we have less than 3 months of supply. So, you know, a lot of caution for buyers purchasing older homes. I don't know if there's much we can do about it.
Dave, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Judy now in Madison. Judy, hello.
Hi. A friend of mine from Tennessee was saying that a private equity company has bought up about a quarter of all the houses in a suburb of Nashville. And I wondered if private equity companies are busy in Wisconsin as well, buying up houses for whatever.
Judy, thanks for the call. I've talked to a reporter in years past, Kurt, about at least some of that going on in Wisconsin, in the Milwaukee area, I believe. How common is that, though, for private equity firms to be buying up housing here in the state?
Well, and so, just to put this in context, when a private equity firm is buying up housing, they're usually buying in bulk, and then they're intending those to be rentals, not for ownership. And our friends in Milwaukee have noticed an uptick of private equity companies buying houses in bulk in Milwaukee, but it's still a reasonably small component of the market, even in Milwaukee. I think it's at most 2 or 3%. But this is a big issue and a concern, particularly in a lot of our more southern and East Coast states, where, you know, first-time home buyers, lower to moderate-income home buyers, are priced out because they can't compete with all-cash offers, whether it's from a baby boomer or from a private equity company. So it really, in tight markets, it can drive up prices a little bit, and also just limit opportunities for your first-time home buyers.
And Judy, thanks for the call. You can look at our archives for a discussion with author Aaron Glantz, author of the book Homewreckers, who looked into this issue. This is a couple years back. Dave joins us now in Toma. Dave, hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm on a quest to end urban sprawl, and I want to know what he thinks of this condensed housing and shopping they're putting in the notion, if that could be possibly a good trend for the future.
Dave, thanks for the call. I think a lot of downtowns are seeing this kind of thing, Kurt. Commercial downstairs, residential for, you know, 2, 3, 4 floors up above that. Is this a wave of the future? Is it going to help meet our housing needs?
Yeah, absolutely. So to Dave's comments, you know, for 70 years, we built our cities where we would segregate the office and employment land uses from the residential land uses, mm-hmm. which forces everybody to drive and creates the sprawl that Dave was talking about. But one of the big trends in housing now is converting these vacant office or retail parcels, because we have a declining demand for office and retail because of e-commerce and work from home, and an opportunity to convert some of those older campuses to a mixture of housing and jobs and retail. In fact, the state legislature recently passed a bill in a series of bills to expand housing supply, and one of those would help to create a $100 million fund to convert commercial land uses that are vacant to housing opportunities. So for many of our cities, whether a suburb or a smaller town, converting some of the vacant retail and commercial space to housing helps to attract customers, helps to replenish your tax base, and helps to provide a variety of housing opportunities in a kind of smaller scale, walkable Main Street sort of format.
Dave, thanks a lot for that call. Now, Kurt, earlier you used the phrase, you know, when the housing market cools down, what would it take for the housing market to cool down?
Well, that's the problem, is I don't think it's going to cool down. Because if construction costs are one of these long-term drivers of housing prices, until we can get construction costs back to what used to be close to normal, housing is going to continue to be expensive. And it's like we're stepping on the gas and the brakes at the same time, because we have this huge demographic surge of millennials who want to buy homes, and there's nothing for them to buy. So I don't see the housing market cooling off anytime in the next 2 or 3 years. I see that the Fed will likely raise interest rates probably once or twice more this year, and that has done nothing to decrease housing prices. The rate of growth has slowed a little bit, but unfortunately, housing prices tend to ratchet up quickly, and they're very slow to go back down.
Assuming, Kurt, we see it as a positive goal to make housing more affordable. I think a lot of people would agree with that as a good goal.
Yes.
Are there measures you could see a federal government, a state government, even a local government taking to help accomplish that?
Right. And so, you know, I think it would be worth pointing out that last week the state legislature passed and the governor signed in a bipartisan fashion about 5 bills, all designed to address the shortage of housing and workforce housing in Wisconsin. And the Joint Finance Committee's budget includes about $500 million for these. And so that's a great down payment from the state to address these issues. I know that there's a lot of legislation at the federal level, but there's also the federal budget challenges. At a local level, it involves communities really inventorying their zoning and other policies to make sure that you know, that kind of smaller scale entry-level housing product can be built in your community, and working with developers to both expedite the process, but also to provide financial assistance to build more housing that's accessible and attainable for moderate income families. But it's a real challenge because, you know, you've got to bridge that gap between how much it costs to build a unit of housing and what people can afford.
In just our last minute or so, Kurt, I know there's not a magic answer, but for that millennial perspective, first-time home buyer we've been talking about in this tough situation, any thoughts, advice, or reassurance you might give them?
Boy, I'd hate to give kind of false reassurance, but the best you can do is to make sure your credit is clean, that you've gone through home buyer education counseling, that you're working with a real estate realtor, and that you know how much you can afford. And I guess the other advice to millennials is to warn your parents that if they don't fix the housing market, you might be moving back in with them. And maybe that will scare people into action.
Kurt, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison's Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture. He joined us with a look at the latest on the housing market here in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Wisconsin Republicans laid out their plans for income tax cuts last week. Find out how that compares to Governor Evers' plans and the impact it could all have on Wisconsin. And can we agree on the meaning of patriotism in a time of partisan divide? A Wisconsin ethics expert starts our conversation on patriotism. That's 1 week before the 4th of July, and you can join in with your thoughts. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll get some tips on how to make the most of a trip down the Wisconsin River, and you could share your river paddling memories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a bill that passed the state assembly would allow pharmacists in Wisconsin to prescribe some forms of birth control directly to patients. We'll talk about the role contraceptives play in post-Roe Wisconsin. First, whether it's in a kayak or a canoe, summer's a great time to start paddling. And some of the best paddling in the state, in the Midwest even, is on the Wisconsin River. Our next guest has been planning and guiding trips on the river for years. He joins us now to talk about how to make the most of your time on the river, whether it's a few hours or a few days. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your own river trips, big or small, on the Wisconsin River or elsewhere. Do you have a favorite stretch of Wisconsin's longest river, the Wisconsin River? Where else do you like to paddle? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences or your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Scott Teuber is founder and owner of Wisconsin River Outings. He's an American Canoe Association certified canoe and kayak instructor. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's a pleasure being here. Getting to talk to all of Wisconsin at once is incredible.
Now, do you remember your first time out paddling on the Wisconsin River?
So, yes, it turns out I used to teach in the Chicago area, and a friend of a friend did guided trips on the Wisconsin River. And on a fluke, I went up during our summer break from teaching to paddle the Wisconsin, not knowing, never having a dream that I would end up owning a business on it for the last 20 years.
Yeah, something about, I guess, that trip clearly captured your attention. What is it that made you fall in love with paddling on Wisconsin River so much that you made your career out of it?
I think we're so lucky to be in a place where, as I call it, civilization, meaning larger towns, Madison, Milwaukee, Chicago, are within a half day's drive of being somewhere, while not boundary waters remote. But once you get on the Wisconsin River, it's a wilderness experience. you're on your own. You need to make it to the next boat landing if you're having troubles or want to get off. There's no just pulling up and heading towards the road. And, you know, we're losing a sense of that. And I'm proud that I get to introduce people to that kind of experience, to feel so far away, but make a weekend of it, 3-4 days, whatever they can fit into their schedule.
And I read on the DNR website, the lower Wisconsin River, where it leads into the Mississippi, it is the longest stretch of free-flowing, meaning no dams in the middle of it, free-flowing river in the Midwest. That gives a lot of opportunities for different kinds of trips, right?
It does. And, you know, I've known that for years, and I still find it shocking. But whether it's dams or just rivers that don't go that long before they dump into the into the next larger body of water, it's fascinating. Between that and the Wisconsin River is known as the hardest working river in the country. I think we're down to 22 dams that are left on it. You know, that's a combination of, for flood control as well as energy, and you know, trying to balance out high and low waters. But the Wisconsin River is really quite an interesting river in the Midwest, and for that matter, the country.
Before we get into some of the practical sides of things, what are some of your favorite wildlife sightings that you've seen along this wild river? As you say, just a half-day ride from a lot of civilization.
Well, and actually the first one, I was above the river. I was walking over a bridge, basically trying to spot customers and get a sense of where people were at. And a snapping turtle that, granted, I was, you know, 15, 20 feet above it, but was larger than a trash can laying on its side, a large trash can laying, was slowly working its way underwater upriver. That's probably the most fascinating thing I've seen. But actually, year before last, so during those COVID summers, I was on a sandbar just upriver from Muscadet, and I was out on a day paddle with a friend, and we stopped to stretch our legs, and we saw bear paw tracks in the sand. You know, obviously not an actual sighting of a black bear, but no doubt it was a black bear. That was pretty neat. And then it's the typical stuff. The number of bald eagles now along the Wisconsin, from what I understand from my contacts at the DNR, is the Wisconsin River is actually fully populated at this point with nests for bald eagles. They need about a mile and a half between each. And all of those nesting sites are taken, so they're now working their way up the tributaries. I was out 2 weeks ago for a day paddle. I don't get to get out very often, but and I am not exaggerating. We saw at least 10, if not 15 eagles, and I swear it was not the same one over and over again.
Talking to Scott Teuber with Wisconsin River Outings, looking at river trips, paddling in Wisconsin, especially along the Wisconsin River. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you want some practical advice on planning a river trip from our guest, or you have a favorite memory, a favorite experience to share on the Wisconsin River or other rivers around the state or beyond, join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Scott, let's look at your longer expeditions now, multi-day trips, sandbar camping. What goes into planning one of those?
So the bulk of our business is rentals, and we have a lot of the information laid out on YouTube and for customers to read up on. But, you know, primarily we're in the logistics business. We're trying to move people and boats up and down river as efficiently as possible. Because I'm further down river, so there's 92 miles between the dam in Sauk City and Wyalusing State Park. That whole stretch is the free flow stretch that we were talking about. There's no dams. There's a handful of bridges. I think we're around 8. So fairly remote. And we're 2/3 of the way down the river from Sauk City and about 30 miles upriver from the Mississippi. Most of our business is coming from the east heading west. So we have them stop along the way, empty out people and gear, their coolers, tents, sleeping bags, all that good stuff. And then just the drivers continue down to our shop, because most of our business is doing a panel that's upriver from us and finishing in Boscobel. So we get them loaded up, those drivers, any gear they've rented from us in the boats, and drive them upriver. And then they put on and they're basically paddling back to their vehicles. We do provide some camping gear for rent, but meals and those kinds of things are all on the customer to bring and prepare for. And we have all sorts of tips and suggestions regarding how to feed yourself while you're on the river.
Yeah, let's get some advice there, because you've got a canoe and that's the room you have to work with. What do you recommend for people packing when it comes to their food for their camping stops along that river trip?
So the first thing to think about is the difference between a canoe and kayak, which should be pretty obvious. You know, the canoe, although we discourage it, you can pretty much bring the kitchen sink within reason. A kayak, I refer to that as backpacking on the water. You need a smaller tent if you need the god of the nectar, the nectar of the gods in the morning, coffee. If you're in a kayak, you probably want to have a small camping stove, backpacking stove. You're not going to be able to have anything large, extravagant, heavy, because you'll be super limited on space. Regarding meals, you know, it really runs the gamut. I was just talking to a customer this weekend who frequents I'm going to go ahead and say it. He frequents Bob's Bitchin' Barbecue in Dodgeville. His family goes there first, eats lunch before they come and paddle for a multi-day trip, and then they get like a couple pounds of meat from there and just warm it up on the river.
Nice.
And that's probably my biggest suggestion. If you haven't done this very often, create meals that are easy to just warm up on the river. Make pasta sauce and just boil pasta and throw the sauce on it. Fajitas are really kind of one pan, easy to make. But we've got folks, and I've got pictures to prove it, who do steak and lobster out on the river. So it really is anything from sandwiches on. And then, as I say, it's about cooler management. If you're going to be out for a few days, you need to find ways of keeping whatever it is you're bringing out cold for that amount of time. And my biggest suggestion is labeling coolers. Make sure everybody understands you don't open coolers just to look at them, because each time you open that lid, you're losing that cool space. And basically, this is day one, lunch and dinner. This cooler is day two, breakfast and lunch. And then maybe day three is that night's dinner and the following morning's breakfast, and then they're coming off. Some of those logistical planning things that you'll learn a lot after just a trip or two.
We've got lots of callers. Let's bring on Mark now in Sheboygan. Mark, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that on the Sheboygan River, there are tons of fish in autumn in particular. And at Kohler Company, they've got something called river wildlife, in particular at the American Club. If people want to become a member at River Wildlife, I was a member there. What we would do is we would go fishing on the river, and they've got a place where the salmon and all kinds of fish bottle up, and they jump over the river. There's literally millions of fish that go over the river there.
Interesting, Mark. Thanks a lot for that tip. Scott, do a lot of your clients do some fishing along the way on the Wisconsin River?
Honestly, not many of them, but there are a handful that go out on a mission to fish. Everything from live bait, lures, to we have quite a few fly fishermen also who go out. And honestly, that's a special sight to be paddling down the river and come around a corner where somebody is, you know, working a drop off and fly fishing. It's poetry. It's really pretty. So
thanks a lot for the call, Mark. We're talking to veteran river trip planner Scott Teuber with Wisconsin River Outings, talking about how to have a fun and safe adventure on the Wisconsin River or elsewhere. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Any advice, any lessons learned from your own experiences paddling on rivers? Any favorite memories of being on the Wisconsin River or one of our many other rivers around the state? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences or questions. That's 800-642-1234. 642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Scott Teuber, owner and founder of Wisconsin River Outings and certified paddling instructor, talking about how to make the most out of your trip down the Wisconsin River or elsewhere. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your river paddling memories, experiences, questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Bob is with us in Rhinelander. Bob, hi.
Hi, I worked on the Wisconsin River to protect the water quality for over 45 years. When I started, the foam was so great on the Wisconsin River below Rothschild, you could paddle a canoe in the foam and you couldn't even see it. Below Rhinelander, the whole river was covered with sludge so small animals could walk across, and there was zero dissolved oxygen. Using the Clean Water Act, we cut back the paper mills, the 15 pulp and paper mills, by 93%. And the river recovered. It's in good water quality condition right now, but I'd like to remind people that it can go back to bad water quality if you're not vigilant, and that it's really important economically and environmentally and socially to protect rivers. And organizations in the state, like Wisconsin's Green Fire, advocate for science-based natural resources management instead of political management. The political people on the river said it couldn't be done. The river would always be an industrial river, and it was just not true. We used the science, we cleaned up the river, and everyone benefited.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Scott, what are you seeing with your firsthand look at the water quality on that stretch of the Wisconsin River we're talking about?
Well, the first thing I'll do is thank Bob because of the work he did who knows how many years ago. I'm able to run a successful business on a river that like we just got done talking about, is special. You know, my drivers, when we drop folks off at boat landings, and even in working with our customers, we do our best to make people cognizant of whether it's picking up trash, not buying the 24 pack of plastic bottles, but at worst case scenario, buying 1 gallon jugs. And then preferably buying a jerry can, which we also rent and reuse those. You know, we spend time talking about dealing with human waste on the Wisconsin River because that first stretch through from Sauk City down to Spring Green, it sees a lot of traffic. It's close and convenient to Madison. It's easy for day trippers out of Madison. And, you know, there's a lot of humans that go through there, in particular in July and August. So by everybody participating, following rules, and one of the organizations I want to shout out to is the Lower Wisconsin Riverway. There is a lot of information on their website, not only about the history of the Lower Wisconsin, but ways of protecting it, dealing with waste, whether that's human or trash. It also has a list of the outfitters that are there. There's a lot of information there for you to absorb also.
Thanks for that call, Bob. Before we go to another caller, Scott, let's talk about, we've been talking about protecting the environment on the river. How about safety? What are some pieces of safety advice you give paddlers, you know, maybe beyond the obvious things people might not think about on the river?
So the Wisconsin River is sandy. I'm sure just about everybody listening has driven over it at some point and seen all the sandbars, and you can experience that pretty much, I believe, all the way up to Merrill. I mean, it's pretty consistent the way it is the whole way through. This lower stretch, though, it runs a little slower. It runs wider, which provides a lot of drop-offs. So the bottom is always shifting over time as those sand particles move their way downriver. The first thing is, if you're going to go to the extreme, is if your feet are wet, you should have a vest on. And in particular, I'm actually shocked by the number of people we put on the river every year who will admit they don't know how to swim. And, you know, we always make sure their vest is well fitted and they understand they need to be wearing it at all times, because on the Wisconsin, you can be walking in ankle or calf deep water 1 minute, and if you're not paying attention, take two more steps and you're going to be up to your hips or deeper. And if you're uncomfortable in the water, that's not a good recipe. The other thing is, especially for people who are used to paddling or doing activities on lakes, you know, when you're on a river, you're always moving. So whether you're out there swimming or the kids are out there swimming, somebody's got to be the one to say, guys, I don't know if you've noticed, but you've drifted 50 yards downriver. You need to stand up, get out of the water, come all the way back up, and you can and do that again. And then when you're paddling, and I've seen this because I've paddled with some younger kids, middle school kids in particular. I used to teach middle school, so this might not be that surprising, but they seem to forget if you stop paddling, that doesn't mean you stop moving. So they might be heading somewhere they don't want to go, and they stop paddling. It's like, no, you actually need to keep paddling, but you need to steer that canoe out of the trees or whatever. That's another important thing to remember, that you're always moving on a river, and you have to take that into account.
Let's bring on another caller. John is with us in Brown Deer. John, hi.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you for accepting my call. I know a nice smooth river trip. It starts in the upper Namabin Lake, and one has to find the entrance from that lake into the Bark River. And then it's a very winding waterway, and one paddles with the current through a number of curves and twists and turns and so forth, and winds up in another small lake. And from that other small lake, I don't even know if it has a name, one can embark or begin another trip on the Bark River, and you can go as far southeast as one wants to on the Bark River. But it's a very nice casual trip between the upper Namabin Lake to that second lake that I mentioned. And one can take a fishing pole, can go fly fishing, or you can go any type of fishing in there, pack a lunch, eat it during the day. It's very pleasant.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Scott, I know your business keeps you on the Wisconsin River, but you know, have you had good experiences on more out-of-the-way rivers in your paddling career?
Lucky enough, I'm a member of America Outdoors, also Professional Paddle Sports Association, and I have friends throughout the country. Little rivers in Indiana, the Pigeon, in Kentucky. I've done quite a few rivers in Florida, lots of day trips to do in Florida that with just crystal clear water. And actually this fall, early November, I'm doing the Rio Grande for the third or fourth time with friends. So, yeah, I mean, there's way too many out there. No one's ever going to do them all. But you try and find good ones that'll fit the bill for what you're trying to accomplish, and just do some research.
And in just our last minute or so, how about that first timer, somebody who's never been out on a river or hasn't been since maybe they were a kid? What would you recommend as a good starting expedition for them?
You know, the Kickapoo around Madison. Well, the Kickapoo on weekdays around Madison, the Sugar River in Burlington. Is it the Upper Fox, I believe? There's so many. Only small concern right now is keeping an eye on water levels. Lucky enough, we got a little bit of rain, and hopefully that'll add. But the Wisconsin has enough water, but some of these others may be real sensitive to rainfall.
Scott, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Scott Teuber, founder and owner of Wisconsin River Outings. He's an American Canoe Association certified canoe and kayak instructor. He joined us today to share his advice for planning your next adventure on the Wisconsin River. We'll get a link to his website and some of those YouTube instructional videos. You can find him at wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a reproductive rights expert about access to contraceptives in Wisconsin. That after the state assembly passed a bill that would allow pharmacists to prescribe some forms of birth control directly to patients. Still up in the air if it's going to even be considered in the state Senate in this session. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.